This is Behind the Docs, the show that shines a spotlight on the people shaping how we understand and use technology. In each episode, we pull back the curtain to talk about what it's really like to create the docs we all rely on. Let's dive in.
Welcome to Behind the Docs, the show that shines a spotlight on the people shaping how we understand and use technology. In each episode, we pull the curtain back to talk about what it's really like to create docs that we all rely on. Today, we're talking to Manny Silva. Welcome, Manny.
Thanks for having me, Patrick.
It's very exciting to have you here. So you are head of documentation at Skyflow, but you're also many other things. You're a published author, and you're the creator of Doc Detective, right?
I wear a whole lot of hats, yes.
A lot of very interesting hats, too. So I think we'll try to get into a little bit of all of that today. But before we really jump into, you know, the many different things that you work on and contribute to the community on a daily, monthly, weekly basis, I'd love to understand how you found your way into the world of TechCom.
Sure. So it begins when I was but a wee lad. I grew up with my mother disassembling and reassembling computers on the kitchen countertop. At the time, she worked for a now long defunct computer company doing sales, and she figured the best way to sell computers was to literally understand them inside and out. And so my brother and I, older brother and I, learned how computers worked. And my godfather at the time worked for AMD. And so he would be building his own computers, have some spare parts, would bring them over. So my brother and I grew up building computers. Also, I was an avid gamer. And so I ended up making my computer bend over backwards to do things that it wasn't intended to do in service of seeing just how far I could push it. But as I got older, I also realized that I had a knack for the English language. Thank you, high school English teacher. So when I got to college, I was majoring in English, but I knew I wanted to do something about tech. I knew I didn't want to be an engineer because I didn't want to be on call. If I could only see where I am now. But I was looking at the different degrees and programs and things. I was like, how do I mix tech and language? And I found technical communications. Like, that's it. That's what I'm doing. So I was an oddball, and I did both I did dual concentrations in creative writing and in professional and technical writing. And then I did my master's in technical communication, and I worked at Apple and Google and now Skyflow.
Was there a technical communications master's program where you went? Where did you say you went to college? I'm sorry, I missed it.
So my undergrad, I did San Jose State University in California. Okay. And my master's, I did Minnesota State University, Mankato. No, I did not move to Minnesota. It was one of the programs that was remote before it was cool. And yeah. I did that while I was working at Apple.
Okay. And they had a master's in technical communication.
Correct. Still do.
Got it. Very cool. Yeah. So there's, I only know of a few institutions that have that program. Like Virginia Tech is one of them. I didn't know about Minnesota. So that's very cool. I'm actually curious. So if you were going back and you were starting over today and kind of going down that track, like think if you're giving a little bit of advice to somebody who's, you know, you going into college, you know, would you follow the same path or would you take a different one into this world?
If I was going back to talk to myself, knowing what I know now, or, you know, talking to somebody who's trying to get in now, the biggest disservice I did to myself is, and this is going to sound really ironic, but I didn't get into the tools of it early. I didn't get my hands dirty with the different capabilities that all of the awesome tooling out there offers. It took me a decade to teach myself HTML, CSS, JavaScript, how to do all of the crazy stuff that I do nowadays, how do databases work, all of that. That part was all self-taught, and it was a lot harder than it needed to be. And so I would have told myself, hey, you know what? Do what you're passionate about, but also make sure you have a solid grounding in all of the technical concepts and tools that you're going to end up documenting. I would have taken some of those computer science classes that at the time I avoided.
Interesting. I was going to say, because when you were giving your rationale for going into technical content, you said you didn't want to be an engineer. You're one of the more engineer-y technical writers that I know. So it seems like you kind of found yourself there anyways.
Yeah, and I am certainly on call in a few different ways, depending on how you look at it on a regular basis. But yeah, I'm a tinkerer. I have a 3D printer. I always find myself trying to optimize, but not over-optimize things and how I work and how I perceive and organize and manage the projects that I work on. It's part of my nature. And so I'm not at all surprised that I ended up here, but I definitely could have prepared myself for it a little better.
That makes a lot of sense. And so when we talk about where you ended up, right now here is Skyflow,
Yes.
and you're head of documentation, but you're also the rest of documentation, right?
Yes, at the moment I'm a one-man show. That has not always been the case. That will not always be the case, but at the moment I am. But also I'm not in that I solicit contributions to the documentation from the entire company. I own the documentation, and not just the docs, but really everything that is user-facing that involves words that is not marketing. So UI copy, error codes, error messages. I have input on API surface area and naming. I have input on SDK surface area and naming. Like all of it may not be exclusively my domain, but I am responsible for at least in part.
That's wild. One of the things I think is really interesting about where you are, and I want to ask you the kind of canned question in a second, like what does your day look like? Because that's you have a super interesting answer to that. But before we go there, this feels to me like your role is becoming more and more commonplace, where you have kind of the one writer extraordinaire that isn't really just a writer. They're also so many other things, and they hold up all these systems, and they're like this major interconnection point. So I'm kind of curious, like, how do you see the technical writer role in the context of like what you described evolving in the future? Do you think there's going to be more and more kind of one-man bands that sit at this intersection, or do you think that there's going to continue to be like large teams?
It depends on what you're working on. And I promise it's not a cop out. If you're working in with products that are highly interoperable, software documentation, for example, then I see it being smaller, more agile teams that do a lot. And they're going to be able to solicit content faster and questionably higher quality, depending on what tools and guardrails they put in place for themselves. But when you're dealing with other sorts of products, physical things, hardware, medical services and devices, that sort of stuff, there's only so much you can scale up in that way because the product and information you're working with is not, you can't do quite as fast of iterations. So it has to go a little slower. And in those cases, you're likely going to have more people to track, just to track down all of the necessary information, let alone do the writing. I do think that writing teams overall across the board are going to get smaller, personally. But I also think it's going our specialty and being at this intersection, not only of the documentation, but frankly, of being experts in the sorts of content that power AI systems like AI agents, position us extremely well to be more present in organizations that normally wouldn't care about us as much.
It's funny that you say that because that's my perspective too. And we didn't share notes on this beforehand. So I think you're probably right that over time, the size of many teams will come down. Like how much I think is still yet to be seen. I can see certain circumstances where it's substantial and other ones where I don't think it'll move much at all. But I think the thing that you said at the end there is the critical piece, which is that there's so many companies that don't have any technical writers. Like they just don't. They don't do anything with it. And when they see the quantity of value that people who are in this field are able to bring to an organization from a customer experience, from a total process, and just information as it relates to either GEO, SEO, whatever, I think that they're going to start to stand up and listen a lot more. So I actually think there will be more technical writers. I just think that they'll be probably less often in teams and more often they'll look kind of like you.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, the way I see myself right now, I mean, you could call my title so many different things. Like as far as what you label my work, I could be a doc operations expert, I could be a documentation engineer, I could be a technical writer, I could be a technical content owner. I do all of these things, but I see myself as a content curator, that where it doesn't matter where the content comes from, whether it's human or AI created, I care that it's edited, that it holds our standards, and that it meets my users' needs. And I am also the one in charge of maintaining all of the systems that go in to upholding those qualities, to upholding the standards. I'm the one who organizes and defines all of the AI tooling that goes into this. And so it's a very systems heavy way of thinking about it.
That makes sense to me. And I suspect that you're probably in the top whatever percentile in terms of like total output as just a human being. So I think that more commonly you're going to see your role in like two or three people. And especially if that organization has more content, right? Like there's a certain volume like you just can't handle. So I think you'll see the doc ops. I think you'll see somebody who's like truly the content owner who's like actually like more in the words and those kinds of things. But I think the mix of stuff that you're bringing to Skyflow is probably the future.
I agree. And I mean, yeah, I'm a one-man show right now, but it cannot and will not be that way forever. So I agree. An awesome team size would be like five people. And we could do so much. We could do so much with the tools that we have available to us today.
Five is such a good team size for especially software companies, it seems. Like there's something about that 4 to 7 people range that you're able to just move so quickly, but like those teams can also produce so much.
Yes. Well, and it allows you to have a closer knit culture. It allows everybody to get more on the same page. You could get everybody into a room to, brainstorm and hash out a solution to a potential problem, and it's not overly burdensome. If you're in person, you can actually, go out and get a reservation at a restaurant to go enjoy a nice lunch or dinner or something. I mean, it's just very good range.
For sure. And that's the thing that people, I feel like since COVID, people do not value that as much as they should. But those after work conversations, they are what lay the social fabric for you to move more quickly in collaboration, at work. So I love that. I think that's absolutely right. A good size for a team is often the size that you can get a reservation for.
I mean, I'll be honest, part of the reason I did as well as I did when I was at Google was because of my teammates who supported me and who helped mentor me. And I tried to pay that back by mentoring other younger, newer writers when I was at Google. And nowadays, I just try to give back to the community at large. It is something that the culture is incredibly important to me.
Totally. Absolutely. So I want to actually kind of key off of that and talk about some of the projects that you're most interested in.
Sure.
So let's pause on the community at large for just a second. We'll come there, I promise. But let's start by talking about some of the things you've done, at your standard 9 to 5 at Skyflow that you're most proud of in recent history.
Sure. So, two things that I've done that are very closely tied together are I have been putting together some automated authoring workflows and some of those guardrails that I mentioned earlier. But I've also done a lot to lower the barrier of entry for content contributions from everyone in the company. These go very tightly hand in hand. And what that looks like is, forgive me, I'm going to get into systems again. It's just how I
No,
think.
it's please.
And I, by identifying the ways in which to reduce friction for getting contributions, and then the optimal ways to ensure that content upholds our standards, and doing that with as little effort on my part as possible, I've ended up with the system that I have that I'm currently building out now. What it looks like is my contributors are oftentimes product folks or engineers, sometimes sales folks. I've gotten many times customer success folks. I've gotten contributions from every different role in the company, but they're often in Slack or they're in Jira, and those are the two most common entry points. And so, we might be having a con somebody might be having a conversation in Slack and say, "Hey, this really needs to get documented. Hey, Manny," and tag me, and it's like, "Great, thanks for this ad hoc work that I wasn't accounting for." And so, how do I keep that from disrupting my day? I've built it out such that I can, from Slack, create a Jira ticket, and then from that Jira ticket, can say, "Yes, this is approved," after reviewing the work proposal. And then my systems go and look at the source Slack thread, find all of the documents and spreadsheets and such that were mentioned or referenced, and fetch that content, attach all of it to the Jira ticket, and then go off and pass it along to an AI agent that goes and does the first draft of that content. And then, as part of how the agent works, it checks against our style guide deterministically using Vail in particular. And then it fixes all of the errors that it finds. It goes in and does an editing pass all on its own to hold to our editorial standards and our documentation structures. It uses the templates we've defined in the first place to scaffold all of the documentation that it creates. And on the other side, I get a ping saying, "Hey, this is ready for review. And Manny, you need to take a look at this." And at that point, I'll review it myself, see if it needs additional updates. If there's not enough information, the automations will flag it as needing additional subject matter expert information. And so I'll route it back to the appropriate person. And if I have to manually update things from there, I will. It speeds things up a ton. It also means that I have a lot more to review than I used to. But also, not everyone just wants to kick off conversations in threads. Some, or kick off edits in threads. Some people want more nuanced control. And for them, I personally work in a docs as code setup. And so I've made it such that I can offer anyone at the company access to the raw content source. If they want to edit it directly, they can, but a lot of people don't. So for them, I have a no-code WYSIWYG, or what you see is what you get editor, that they can go in and, like Notion, go in and make whatever changes they want. And then on the back end, it still ties into my workflows, so I still get all of that review and guardrails checks and all of that. But between all these different modes of interacting with the people who need edits, and doing all of that checking on its own, it while it does create review work for me, it's a lot better than a PM just saying, "Hey, Manny, I tossed together this slop from ChatGPT based on a conversation that I had with it. You should put this on the doc site."
Yeah, and I can't imagine how many people are dealing with that these days. So how much of the review work do you feel like you just rubber stamp? You just go, okay, that's fine.
None of
Or,
it.
yeah,
I
so there's a lot.
refuse.
Well, but I guess the bigger question is like, how much of it comes back and you really have to get in there and make substantial changes to what the system's created?
If I have to make substantial changes because of system configuration issues, I'll do it once and then I'll use the AI tooling to improve itself to say, hey, we ran into this issue, that issue, and the other issue. Go and look at all of your configuration files and add rules, guidelines, best practices so that they don't happen again. And so I'll do that one time fix. If I run into an issue where it simply wasn't enough information, or it was incomplete information, or I can't confirm on my own that the information is accurate, then I kick it back to whoever started the workflow. I say, hey, you're the one that asked for this. You confirm that it's accurate. And when you can prove that it's accurate, I'll review it again.
So it's a lot of coordination, is what
Yes.
you're saying. Yeah.
Yes, it is. I
Interesting.
mean, a lot of it is automated coordination. Like all I have to do is add a tag to the PR and then it notifies whoever needs to be notified that there's additional review and it's in their hands. But it's a lot of, hey, this is the SLA. I'm going to hold to the SLA for, internal docs efforts, and you're going to play ball or you're not going to get docs written.
That's fair. I mean, you got to put something in and get something out, right?
Exactly. I learned the hard way, the very hard way, that other people will not respect my time for me. I have to do it and I have to hold firm boundaries because they're not there to manage my work. I'm there to manage my work, and there's only one of me.
Amen. I think a lot more people could use to have that policy set for setting that policy for themselves, I guess I should say. So I want to pivot over to some of your non-Skyflow work, the stuff that you do out in the community. So I think as many people will know, you are the Doc Detective, or maybe you're the creator of the Doc Detective. I don't know which one do you, whichever one you want to be. But you have this very interesting project. So tell us a little bit about Doc Detective.
Sure. So Doc Detective is a toolkit for validating your documentation's accuracy and doing a whole bunch of related things. What that actually means in practice is if you have a procedure, Doc Detective can step through your procedure and actually do it to make sure that it works as written, doing things like verifying button labels, making sure that elements that you reference exist, that you can actually type in the strings that you're telling your users to type in, or make the API calls, or run the CLI commands with expected outputs, and all that jazz. But some of the really exciting, nifty things that it can do is automated screenshots, being able to go in and say, oh, hey, look, this part of the workflow, it looks like this. And then, if that screenshot's already been captured once, it goes through and captures a new one and compares it to the old one. And we'll just tell you, hey, this has changed a lot more than expected or is acceptable. So I'm just going to update the new one for you, and you can choose to keep it or not. But here it is. So no one ever has to update another screenshot again, as long as, or capture another screenshot again, as long as they're you testing their docs. But it's the same thing for API calls and CLI commands. You can look at the outputs, you can store the outputs. That way, you don't have to go in and say, oh, hey, the response should look like this. You can directly transclude it into your guides so that you can say, and this is the output, and be confident about it. Doc Detective is a way to make sure that engineering doesn't break your docs with unexpected changes. And also, if you have big changes coming down to the pipe, to make sure that you actually caught every edge case so that your users don't get upset, so that you don't get reports through customer experience that, oh, hey, this guide's broken, that guide's broken. You reduce customer churn and all that. You keep your users happy. You keep your internal teams happy by catching bugs earlier, and you get peace of mind because you know that your content is accurate.
Yeah, so it's like it's integration test for content, right?
More or less.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, that's a thing the world has needed for a long time. I've seen some of it run. It is very cool stuff. So you have a wide range of capability for Doc Detective. And I'm assuming you're using it yourself right now at
I am, yeah.
Skyflow.
Yes. And for Doc Detective itself, it's quite meta.
That's awesome. How much time do you spend actually working on the test for Doc Detective?
Myself personally, a lot less than I used to. But previously, what Doc Detective still does, I'll start with that, is it can look at your documentation syntax. If you're working with Ditta, it can look at elements that are tagged as screenshots in an output class. If it can check for external hyperlinks, and looking at all of that, it identifies testable statements based on the syntax itself. And so if it finds a hyperlink, it'll say, oh, hey, look, I need to make sure that this link is valid. If it is a hyperlink prepended by open or go to or another key phrase, it will open up a web browser and navigate there. If there's an image element with a screenshot class, it'll take that screenshot without you having to do anything. But you can also write all of these statements, all of these test steps, inline as comments or processing instructions. I say all of this because before Doc Detect, I used to have to write all of this by hand, either in patterns that would be detected based on my content syntax, or as inline statements. But I recently came out with a set of agentic tools for Doc Detective to teach Claude Code or Gemini CLI or Copilot CLI or whatever other piece of tooling you want how to write Doc Detective tests so
Oh,
that
that's awesome.
it can now, and I was doing this with the Doc Detective docs themselves. I can just say, hey, Claude, look at this file, write tests for it. And it will go, it will interpret the content, it will write tests, it will run the tests for you to make sure that they're valid, debug them. And then the best part yet, it won't save them as a separate test artifact. Now, that's a problem if you do that, because then you're not actually testing the documentation against your product. You're testing your test file against the product.
Right.
And then you can have drift between your documentation and your test files. But because Doc Detective supports these inline test statements, all of this agentic tooling can say, oh, hey, look, we have this valid test. Let's go ahead and inject all those test statements back into your documentation source so that you don't have to maintain it separately.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I think that kind of like true agentic workflow where it's really working alongside you is going to become much more common. And I wonder, as kind of on a general statement, if you were going to give someone advice on, let's say they don't have a lot of experience with AI or systems like that, like they've been more on the writing side of Writer for the last whatever number of years, right? If they said, like, where would you get started so that you would feel more capable of working effectively alongside some of the agentic systems that like you're working on.
Start with Claude. I say this in particular because it frankly doesn't matter which tool you use, as long as you get started. That's getting started with anything is better than not getting started with anything. But if you're going to choose one, I'd say start with Claude because there are lots of different levels of interaction depending on how deep you want to go. There's just like the desktop app that you can chat with and have the sorts of interactions you might have with ChatGPT, but you can hook into more advanced tooling. There, if you go with the like first lowest level subscription plan, then you get Claude Cowork, which lets you give it access to some files on your desktop and do more planning and have it take actions for you, which is like just getting your toes into the water with this agentic tooling. But if you really want to, you can go all the way into Claude Code, which is where you get to control every little bit of what it does and how it operates. And that's where the real magic happens, because there is an entire new category of documentation that exists nowadays that powers these AI tools. And that's something that I don't see a lot of people hear a lot of people talking about. But all of these AI agents, they're documentation top to
Yeah.
bottom with a little
Right.
bit of code sprinkled in,
Yeah.
but it's almost exclusively documentation. And if you can get to that level, you are going to unlock superpowers.
Yeah, I love that because it interacting with Claude. So I actually haven't worked with Cowork at all. I'm feel a little bit embarrassed to admit that publicly. But I do work with Claude Code quite a bit. I think I have like four or five Claude Code CLIs open on my desktop right now on different projects. So I'm very, very much in that part of the world. And Anthropic Claude, that's also my choice of model and organization to work with on here. One of the things that I've been getting more concerned about recently, though, and this is part of the reason I haven't started using Cowork, is the security side of it. So how do you feel putting like sensitive information into Cowork and asking it to do work?
Depends on what you define as sensitive information. I work for,
We
so
might have different
Skyflow
definitions, huh? Yeah.
is a privacy and security company.
Yeah.
And so we deal with like social security numbers and credit card information and that sort of thing. That absolutely never, ever, 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 ever goes into any sort of agentic tooling. Frankly, we don't have access to it for
Yeah.
anyone listening. But so I'm very sensitive to what goes into these tools. Part of the reason why I haven't used Cowork extensively is because I don't want to just give it access to my desktop and everything in my
Right.
personal folder and then say
Right.
go. I mean, from a work perspective, no, that I mean, sure, it's an approved vendor, but that, and we know that they're not going to train on that data, but accidents happen. And I don't want to give it access to all that stuff for personal use. I don't want it available to be able not even to read, but to accidentally delete
Yeah.
aspects of my personal data, my photos, my whatever. And so I one of the reasons I like Claude Code is that it is sandboxed and it has to ask for, well, yes and no. It is l the its scope of access is limited to what you approve.
Yes, it is. I think the fallacy in that, which is the thing I worry about with the human in the loop stuff everywhere, is that when you're really working in Claude Code, you get to a point where you're like, yeah, all right. And you just like kind of keep moving. So I think it's hard to believe for me that people are going to use enough scrutiny on what they're giving it access to really maintain the proper boundaries.
All I will say is I agree completely. Just look at OpenClaw.
Yeah. Yeah. If you don't know what OpenClaw is, Google it. It's interesting.
Interesting is a word.
Yeah. Also, don't install it. Google it, read about it, but do not install it. So yeah, it is a wild and dangerous world out there when it comes to these things. And I will loop back real quickly, and I want to highlight a thing you said a little bit earlier, which is that these things run on documentation. And that is so true. Like one of the things that is always shocking to me is if you are very good at working with like, the markdown or whatever you're using in terms of like documenting the behaviors you expect out of your agents, like how much better you can, how much more precise they can be in their behaviors. So it should be a fairly easy transition from writing to inspire human behavior to writing to inspire artificial intelligence behavior for people in our industry, or at least I'd like to think so.
I mean, just to give a sneak preview, I'm working on my next book right now, and that's an entire section of it. Just defining what these different document types are, the best practices of writing them and working on them and iterating on them and how they all work together to influence agentic behaviors. So yes, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Amazing. I love that you dropped the plug for that book in there. That's fantastic. Well, Manny, we've already burned through our time and we didn't even get to all of our questions. So maybe we'll have to have you back. But I do think I got to close it off here so that we don't end up with some kind of a Lex Fridman style podcast where we've been talking for the better part of a day. It's been fantastic having you on. You're such a delight to talk to. And I hope everybody found this to be really interesting.
Thank you for having me, Patrick. It's always great to chat, and I'm happy to come back anytime.
Thanks. See you soon.
Take care, all.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Docs, where the content's structured, but the conversations aren't. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and share it with someone who loves great documentation as much as we do. Until next time, keep creating content that makes a difference.